Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the corroboration by U.S. investigators of details in the controversial intelligence dossier of compromising information the Russians have on Trump and suspected links the Trump campaign had with the Kremlin. Dr. Rachel Kleinfeld, a senior associate in the Democracy and Rule of Law program at the Carnegie Endowment of International Peace and a former member of the Foreign Affairs Policy Board, the advisory board to the United States Department of State, joins us to discuss the countervailing efforts of the Republicans to slow walk the Senate Intelligence Committee inquiry and shut down the Justice Department Inspector General's investigation into the alleged Russian interference in our recent elections, and calls by Nancy Pelosi and other Democrats for an independent and thorough investigation to clear the air and come to a complete understanding of what was an apparent attack on American democracy itself. Then Middle East expert and veteran former CIA officer Robert Baer joins us. He is now the national security analyst for CNN, and we will look into rumors of war with Iran as the Trump administration, working closely with Israel's Prime Minister Netanyahu, are recruiting Sunni Arab allies like Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and the Gulf states in what appears to be a coming confrontation with Iran. We'll also investigate off-the-books intelligence and paramilitary private armies that General Flynn, Stephen Bannon, and Eric Prince are reported to be setting up that would appear to be a fulfillment of Oliver North's dream team from a previous disastrous era of White House covert action against Iran. Then finally, Ellis Krauss, Professor Emeritus of Japanese Politics and Policymaking at the University of California, San Diego, joins us to discuss North Korea's launch of a ballistic missile, which occurred during Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe's weekend retreat to Florida, where he met with President Trump for a round of golf and some male bonding. We will also discuss the hawkish responses from both leaders and Trump's reassurance to our ally that the U.S., quote, stands by Japan, its great ally, 100%. And joining us now is Dr. Rachel Kleinfeld, a senior associate in the Democracy and Rule of Law program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, where she focuses on issues of rule of law, security, and governance in post-conflict countries, fragile states, and states in transition. She was the founding president of the Truman National Security Project and is a former member of the Foreign Affairs Policy Board, the advisory body to the U.S. Department of State, and is the author of Advancing Rule of Law Reform Abroad, The Next Generation. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Rachel Kleinfeld.
Thank you, Ian.
And there's been a report from CNN that U.S. investigators are corroborating some aspect of the Russian dossier, the famous or infamous dossier from the former MI6 officer, Christopher Steele, who is now in hiding. There have been a number of arrests of top high-level FSB officers in Russia, and the murder of a very high-level official, Ervinkin, who apparently was both a KGB general and FSB general and the liaison between Session, the head of Rosneft, the state oil company, and Putin himself. So let's start with what's happening in Moscow. If people associated with the Steele dossier are dropping dead and getting arrested, wouldn't that in itself suggest that there may be something to this dossier?
Well, it's certainly an awful lot of smoke for there to be no fire. So, yes, I think these are highly, highly unusual moves for the FSB. That's the successor to the KGB, of course. And they usually operate in a much quieter manner, to say the least. And so the fact that not only are people dying, and not just the individuals that you've mentioned, but, of course, also activists who have been associated with more open government in Russia. One of them has recently succumbed to an attack that people think is probably poison. So there's a lot going on in Russia that appears to be connected to this case in the United States. But, you know, Ian, I'd love to take a big step back, because one thing that's occurred to me with this Russia story is that people like me are talking heads, are telling the American people, look at what's going on with Russia. And what I hear back from a number of people is, well, what's the big deal? Isn't it a good thing for America to have better relationship with Russia? After all, it's not the Cold War anymore. And so I'd like to take a big step back and talk a little bit about why this is a problem before we get into exactly what the problem is.
Well, that's a good idea, simply because Donald Trump himself is the one that puts forth that notion, which obviously resonates, because unfortunately, here in the United States, the one-third of the Americans who voted for him are very much in an alternative universe from the majority who voted against him.
Yes, I think that's true. But I also think that there's a lot of Americans who simply would like more peace in the world. And so they say, well, if we're going to be friends with Russia, that seems to be a good thing, regardless of whether they were positive or negative on Trump. And I think what gets lost in the story is what war looks like today. The book that I'm working on right now is looking at countries that have been at war for a long time, very bad wars, and how some of them came out of it. And one thing that's become clear researching that book is that the way of war has changed. What we used to think of as war is one country invading another country. That almost never happens anymore. What we see now are two kinds of wars. We see civil wars, like what we're seeing in Syria, where other countries pile in. And we see wars that are by stealth. And this is what Russia exceeds. It's the best at in the whole world. And what Russia likes to do is take a group of people within the country. Think of the Ukrainian separatists in the Ukraine. They'll take a group of people within the country, and they support those people. They fund those people. They help those people start conflict within the country. Sometimes it's cyber conflict. Sometimes it's trolling and stealing information and so on within a country. And sometimes it's out-and-out war, like we saw in the Ukraine, where the people funded by Russia took over a portion of the country, blew up a civilian airliner, the Malaysian jet that was carrying hundreds of civilians. So the way that Russia makes war against countries today is to infiltrate a country, use cyber, and use people within the country who may not know that they're being used to fight the country itself. And that's the real problem of what's going on today, is that people who may not know they're being used, who may not know that they're becoming pawns of a bigger Russian game, which Russia's been doing since it was the Soviet Union. They used to do this when they were communists. People who don't know that they're being pawns are being used to help Russia advance its aims. And its aims now are largely just to keep other countries weak and confused and unable to push back against it. So they don't have real positive aims. They're not trying to rebuild a new world. They're just trying to take down the old world. And that's what's so upsetting about Russia seeming to have effects on our election, having these connections with Michael Flynn, and so on and so forth, their propaganda agency becoming so large in the United States, is that this is how they make war nowadays.
And again, I'm speaking with Dr. Rachel Kleinfeld, who's a senior associate in the Democracy and Rule of Law program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. She was a founding president of the Truman National Security Project and is a former member of the Foreign Affairs Policy Board, the advisory body to the United States Department of State, and is the author of Advancing Rule of Law Reform Abroad, The Next Generation. Well, but the idea that we should have peace with Russia, of course, is in effect a no-brainer, and indeed, it does play into this defensive narrative that that one gets from the political left here in this country. I'm on a left-wing radio station. I get most amazing blizzard of angry mail every time I'm critical of Putin, and you're being accused of being a warmonger if you feel that we need to find out what really happened during this election and the extent of Russian involvement. And the Nation magazine and The Intercept and other magazines are very defensive in that regard and accuse people like me of being of McCarthyism, which is very strange. So, and I think it's a reflex. It's a reflex that comes out of this idea that somehow by being critical, you're being some kind of a warmonger or trying to reinvent the Cold War, which is an understandable, NATO expansion eastward has not been helpful, and one doesn't want to be put in that position. But on the other hand, what more evidence do we need that something happened here? And if it did happen, and what we know in broad strokes is, in effect, that American democracy itself was attacked by a foreign power. That ought to get people's attention.
That's exactly right, Ian. And that's why I'm saying it's not just the 23% of Americans who are Trump supporters or whatever the numbers are right now that are the problem. The left is also saying, let's not overheat this story. But the issue is, when a country has already made war on you and they're making war by undermining our democracy, then you do need to have a response. You can't say, well, our democracy doesn't really matter. You know, if you're American, that's what matters more than anything else. And so, and by the way, it's not just America, of course. They've provided loans to far-right parties, anti-immigration parties, racist parties throughout Europe as well. So this is a global strategy that Russia's using to undermine democracy around the world. And they're trying to do it so that there's no one to push back when they decide to drop bombs on innocent people in Syria, or when they decide to arrest their own human rights activists or what have you. So it's really a case where the global left and the right, who used to stand up to the Russian regime, need to say, you know, we care about our democracy more than we care about partisanship. And this is not about Trump. This is not about war. This is really about, can we support the core of what it means to be a sovereign country that's democratic? That means you can't have another country interfering in your elections.
Well, the overriding cloud of doubt is caused by the president himself, who refuses to even criticize Vladimir Putin and even defended him when Bill O'Reilly of Fox News suggested that Putin was a killer. And that you know, was pretty extraordinary, but that's been consistent. So you wonder, why is it that Donald Trump himself doesn't want to remove this cloud of legitimacy or illegitimacy that hovers over his presidency? And you've got people like General Flynn now, apparently. It's amazing to think that the former head of an intelligence agency didn't realize that the NSA monitors phone calls to the Russian embassy in Moscow, but in Washington. But we don't know what
the incompetence of it is. Something, and you know, there's the issue of Russia, but there's also just the issue of, do you want a national security advisor who doesn't know about our core national security and how it functions?
Well, but what was he doing there? We don't know whether or not he was tipping them off, the Siloviki, the KGB, FSB guys around Putin that have become billionaire oligarchs, whether they were about to be sanctioned. We don't know whether they were tipped off so they could move their money before Treasury froze it, or it was simply to arrange this non-response on Putin's part, which Donald Trump subsequently praised as, I knew you were brilliant, move. In other words, not to reciprocate in kicking out diplomats. So either way, there's a thing called the Logan Act, isn't there?
Well, you know, you started with the Steele dossier when we first started talking, and it looks more and more as if parts of that are being corroborated by our own intelligence agencies, and that the links between Trump and Russia that would cause him to have personal financial interests and personal interests in not upsetting Russia so that negative information about him wasn't disclosed, it seems more and more that there's truth to that. We don't know exactly how much. That's still being figured out, but it's disturbing what we already do know. And so the fact that our government might be continuously influenced by the Russian government so that Mr. Trump himself can maintain business ties, can maintain secrecy about things he would like to keep secret, is incredibly disturbing. How can you have a democracy where a foreign country has the greatest say?
Well, what do you make of these rumors that that somehow Edward Snowden is going to be handed over as a gift to Donald Trump? My understanding is that was in many ways the straw that broke the camel's back in the relationship that Putin had with Obama. Apparently, they spoke regularly and often on the phone, and as a personal favor, Obama asked Putin to hand over Edward Snowden, and Putin refused, and that apparently was the last straw for Obama. So if that's true, then maybe there is some truth to the idea that Putin is offered to hand him back to Trump. But there's no way that Snowden would be handed back to the United States and put in jail. Putin would not agree to that, would he?
You know, I'm not going to speculate on Putin's psychological state of mind. I leave that to real.
Well, try doing that for Donald Trump. Try speculating on Trump's state of mind.
Yes. You know, for both of them, you need real psychological experts, I would say, and not national security experts to speculate on their state of mind. But I will say this, that what's going on with Trump and his lack of expertise overseas can often be popular, that people like to see straight talk. They like to see concrete action. you know, the idea that he did something and he got some guy back, that helped. It's much more clear to people than foreign alliances and a liberal internationalist order and all of the gobbledygook that people like I tend to speak about. But the reality is our peace in the world is built on reciprocal relations between countries that have certain ways of working together. And that's maintained a great deal of peace between Russia and the United States for many decades. And it's kind of stunning that we've had that much peace, given how much we have disagreed. And the problem with moving this to a personal relationship, rather than relying on the kinds of agreements that we've had with these countries for a long time, our treaty agreements, our agreements on nuclear weapons and all of these things, as we move to just a personal relationship between Trump and Putin, well, things go wrong in personal relationships, as we all know. And then we have a much more volatile world. Instead of having rules that even the Soviet Union followed because they were embodied in treaties and our country supported treaties and we all stood for the same thing, now, you know, if Putin has a bad day or if Trump has a bad day and they speak poorly of each other, we risk war. I mean, nobody wants that kind of a personal world. And so all of the kind of jargon that people like me use when we talk about the international system, that's what that all comes down to. And I think we're really at risk of it, even if things go better with Russia because Trump has a good relationship with them. You're putting a lot at risk by putting it all on a personal relationship.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, we spoke early in the last campaign, and you'd traveled the country talking about national security issues, and mm-hmm. you noticed that an awful lot of people in the audiences were concerned about immigration, which was never on the radar of foreign policy experts. And it does seem to have played a massive role in this election here in the United States, and it's starting to play a very critical role in the European elections, with Le Pen looking fairly strong in France. Mm-hmm. Fillon has melted down, although he's apparently very close to Putin, which is a bit mysterious. And then in Germany, there's no question that one more terrorist incident and the right wing will get in there on the anti-immigration ticket. And, you know, there's a danger of a kind of illiberal New World Order brewing there. And many people, ascribe that sort of notion to Stephen Bannon. So what can be done, do you think, to show, I mean, I guess these massive demonstrations at airports here in the United States indicated a pushback. But is there a counter strategy to the strategy of xenophobia?
You know, I think there's a couple of things that we need to do. First, we should recognize that the United States is in a much better position on this issue than most of Europe. Most people in the U.S., when they're polled, are pro-immigration. They just want it controlled. They just want it to happen in a way that's vetted. And so at least they believe in immigration at a very deep level, that that's what makes our country great, despite the misunderstandings about how strong our vetting process is for refugees and so on. So there's something to build on. In many European countries, the base view is much, much more negative toward immigrants themselves. And so they've got a much harder problem to deal with. Now, in terms of what we do with it, about it here in the United States and overseas, the first thing I think we need to do is emphasize how positive immigrants have been for our country and how much they've helped our security. I work with a number of military veterans and have worked when I ran the Truman National Security Project with thousands of military veterans whose lives depended on their interpreters from Iraq, from Afghanistan, and so on. And when the United States pulled out of those countries, those interpreters' lives were at stake. They're some of the people that were getting caught up in this refugee ban. I had friends who had to go to the airport to beg to let their interpreters through because these men saved their lives and they wanted to do the same. So we need to emphasize much more that immigrants support our security. And it's not just in little personal ways and like that. It's also that immigrants are often the ones who provide tips to the intelligence agencies about terrorist plots that are happening. They're the ones who are close to the ground and know what's going on and tend to be quite patriotic about being let into this country. So I think we need to emphasize that. We need to deal with the real job problems that we have in this country. I think that we've dismissed for too long the idea that immigration has nothing to do with job loss. I think it has very little to do with job loss, that automation has much, much more of a hit. But in certain areas and certain jobs, immigrants do cause a net loss to individual people. And so we have to address that. We can't just pretend it doesn't exist, and this country needs to start creating jobs again. We also need to put the blame where it really lies. If the problem is in automation, that's not going away. We don't stop robots by keeping immigrants out of our country. And so instead, we need to help America be strong in building new jobs and helping people get those new jobs. And that will do a lot, I think, to reduce people's animosity toward immigrants and foreigners. And the same, of course, goes for Europe, where job loss has been higher, the recession has lasted longer, and that sort of thing. So emphasizing the positive, getting our economy back on track and putting the blame where it really belongs in terms of robotics and how that reduces jobs. And then finally, I would say we need a new deal on immigration. You know, I've been hearing from people around the country about immigration being a problem since about 2006. That's over a decade. People have been really worried for a long time about our lack of control over our borders. Now, the reality is we actually have very strong control over our borders. We have incredibly good at vetting. Our refugees take years before they're allowed to come into this country because they're so carefully looked at, their stories are so carefully corroborated, and so on. So it's not really that we're letting people in who don't deserve to be here. It's that Americans don't know the deal. They don't know the story that we're telling about these immigrants. Now, there's different ways of doing immigration. In America, we prize families coming together, and that means that people have a landing place when they get here. They don't end up without jobs, without homes, and so on. They end up in a short program to help them get started for a couple months, and then they go to their families. In Canada, they prize merit, and they let people in based on their skills. So there's different ways to make the deal with immigrants and your people, and I think we need to be much more explicit with the Americans about what the deal is and make sure that it's okay.
Well, Dr. Rachel Klampel, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks so much, Ian.
You too. And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Rachel Klampfeld, who is a senior associate in the Democracy and Rule of Law program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, where she focuses on issues of rule of law, security and governance in post-conflict countries, fragile states and states in transition. She was a founding president of the Truman National Security Project and is a former member of the Foreign Affairs Policy Board, the advisory body to the United States Department of State, and the author of Advancing Rule of Law Reform Abroad, The Next Generation. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into rumors of war with Iran.
I'm more important in the USA than a spy for the FBI. I'm trained to meet the criminal elite, and I seek out wherever evil resides. I spy. I'm at home.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Robert Baer, one of the most accomplished agents in CIA history and the winner of the Career Intelligence Medal. He's the author of four New York Times bestsellers, including See No Evil and Sleeping with the Devil, How Washington Sold Our Soul for Saudi Crude. He's considered one of the world's foremost authorities on the Middle East and is the current National Security Affairs Analyst for CNN. And his latest book is The Perfect Kill, 21 Laws for Assassinations. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Baer.
Thank you.
And CNN is reporting that U.S. investigators are corroborating some aspects of the Russian dossier put together by the former MI6 officer Christopher Steele, who's now in hiding. Of course, the Trump administration has dismissed this, as they did initially when CNN first reported the existence of the Christopher Steele dossier. They called it fake news. And as you recall from Donald Trump's first presidential press conference, he refused to allow the CNN reporter to ask a question. So how long can the Trump people just play hardball on this and keep every time at more evidence of connections between the Trump campaign and the Kremlin surface? They just keep crying fake news. Do you think that's going to work?
I don't know if it's going to work in the long run, but they don't seem to be changing course at all at this point. I mean, you know, without any sort of independent investigation, this can't be done in Congress. He's just going to go ahead and deny it. I mean, you know, you have to tie it to the Flynn calls to the Russian ambassador. That's a no-no. He should lose his security clearance over that. You don't get to deal with the representative ahead of a state of another country and say, don't worry about the sanctions, or warn them about the sanctions. So it's not just the Steele dossier. Then you also have the question of, why did Comey go public on the reopening the Hillary Clinton's email? This false scandal, and yet he didn't bring up the Russian stuff in the same letter. I mean, you know, all these questions are just sowing distrust in this country, and the more the president calls this fake news, I don't know where it heads up. I've never seen this in American politics or American history ever.
But do you think if Flynn is fired, which I think is increasingly likely, will that help it go away? Because you've got Sessions now at Justice, and he's apparently going to shut down the Inspector General's investigation of what the FBI knows and when did they know it. Then you've got Richard Burr, this very partisan Republican senator from North Carolina, who was on Trump's campaign team as a national security advisor. He's in charge of the investigation in the Senate Intelligence Committee, and that's not going anywhere as far as we know.
Go back to your earlier question, Ian. I think he's just going to stonewall this, because if the facts come out that indeed this is a concerted effort on the part of Russian intelligence to either, you know, it's hard to tell what exactly they were, but anyhow, the point is, if the narrative becomes the Russians helped him become president, he's an illegitimate political figure. I mean, he just is when a foreign government, and he just simply cannot admit that in any sort of a government document. So he'll close down the Department of Justice, the FBI investigation. He'll get the CIA to shut up about it. I just would be very surprised that unless there's some big leak coming that I don't know about, that we're going to ever come to closure on this.
And what do you think is the likelihood of the press pursuing this? They seem to get distracted by the daily kind of chaos, I guess, is the best way to describe what's happening in the White House. It's difficult to determine whether anybody's in charge in the White House. A lot of people ascribe growing power to Stephen Bannon, and he's even been described as a de facto president. But in view of the chaos, it seems like the last person that talked to Trump is the last thing that he tweets about. So what's your sense then of whether the press has dropped the ball on this story? Because you have to admit it's a big deal when you think about it in the broadest context. You know, a foreign power led by a leader who seems to be quite hostile to the United States, interfering in our elections, attacking the very nature of American democracy. You would think that every red-blooded American would be up in arms about it, but apparently not.
There was a time they would have been, mm-hmm. but there's a new outrage every day. I mean, and now it's apparently that we've turned the White House into a commercial platform for the Trump family. That I don't know about you, but when I grew up, that just was unthinkable. And now you have Congress saying, well, you know, conflict of interest rules don't play. So what you do, if you're in a situation like this, just change the subject every day and attack the press. This is very much in lines with an authoritarian government that will control. I mean, and then, of course, then there's attacking the federal court system.
Well,
which is new ground too,
right? Well, apropos attacking the press, I mean, apparently Trump heard of the press down there at Mar-a-Lago when he was having his golf game with the Japanese Prime Minister Abe. He herded them into the basement of the golf club and put garbage bags up to cover the windows.
You have to keep a sense of humor. I mean, of course, what scares us all is this man has his finger on nuclear trigger.
Right. Well, let's turn to the idea of not the nuclear trigger, but the covert war trigger. It looks as though there's a war brewing with Iran or an incident with Iran, and it does appear that both the Trump administration and Prime Minister Netanyahu, who is visiting Washington on Wednesday, apparently Netanyahu and the White House are organizing the Sunni Arab states of Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and the Gulf into some kind of confrontation against Iran. What puzzles me is how can you have an initiative to have better relations with Russia and maybe make a deal over Syria at the same time go after Iran? I just don't see how...
Well, you can't. I mean, clearly this will set the Russians off in an unpredictable way if we go after the Iranians. When you go after the Iranians in this part of the world, that means Syria, Lebanon, and Iraq. So the entire Levant, the Fertile Crescent, you've got to go to war, with these people, because they're everywhere. I mean, the Iranians, in effect, through Hezbollah, control the government in Lebanon. They are propping up Bashar al-Assad, and so is Russia. And I think right now the Russians are getting buyer's remorse about Trump, because there's nothing rational about foreign policy coming out of this, this White House, or consistent. The Gulf states would dearly love Trump to take the Iranians on. It would solve Saudi Arabia's problem. They think it would in Yemen. It would right things in Iraq for them on the side of the Sunnis. And that's why you see the Saudis they're not criticizing the Trump administration at all about Muslim travel ban.
Well, they weren't on the list, though, were they?
No, they weren't on the list, and there's no explanation why they weren't. They haven't completely taken care of, Sunni Wahhabi-based terrorism coming out of Saudi Arabia. They still haven't really come to, cooperate in the investigation of 9/11. There are 15 Saudis on those airplanes. There's a lot of unanswered questions. They're certainly better than they were 15 years ago. But, it's not clear. This was an expedient, this Muslim ban. And I could see Trump and the people around him who do not understand. There's nobody there that has any concept of how complicated and how fragile a political situation in the Middle East, to actually stir something up. And it's so easy to do any small accident between our forces and the Iranian forces in the Gulf could kick this off. And then, who is advising Trump on Iran? Is it Jared Kushner, who claims to be in charge of the Middle East? Is it Bannon? Neither of whom understand the basics of Islam. I mean, they think that the Muslim Brotherhood is a terrorist organization. They're going to get it on a list.
Mm.
It's much more complicated than that. So you're, I think if I were a betting man, I'd bet we have some sort of, we end up in a conflict with Iran in spite of Russia.
And would this be sparked by these mercenary armies like the ones that Eric Prince has in the Gulf? He's apparently close to Bannon and close to the Trump White House. His sister, after all, has just been made the Secretary of Education.
Eric Prince is very close. He is he's very close to this administration, close to Bannon. He has taken this neoconservative idea that our intelligence, all of it, the community has failed. It hasn't understood the threat of Islam. He's resentful that he was kicked out of Iraq in 2007. He's resentful he was sort of put aside by the Bush administration and, of course, the Obama administration. And now he's coming back with a vengeance. And there's just a lot of people around him as well. You know, the problem always with Trump is that he does, you know, in spite of all making things up, you know, facts and the rest of it, he does address real grievances like immigration. I mean, immigration, we do have problems. I mean, if somebody shows up at our Mexican border and says that they are afraid for their lives, they have to let them in. There's no way for Homeland Security to vet these people. They come up with no passports. There's been no terrorism across the Mexican border we know of, but nonetheless, this has to be fixed in Congress, not by executive order, by bans. And Iran is on the rise in the Middle East, thanks to the Bush administration. It is a threat to the Sunni Arabs, but going to war with it at this point is going to get us into a conflict we're not going to get out of easily. It's not saying, you know, we can't declare victory and leave. It'd be too serious. And the Iranians, number one, would close the Strait of Hormuz. If the United Arab Emirates, Qatar, any of these countries support Saudi Arabia, the Iranians will just flatten the oil facilities with their missiles. Maybe that's what Russia wants. I don't know. Things are so crazy, Ian, that don't even bother to predict, you know, try to predict what's going to happen next, other than something bad.
So do you think that, is there any chance of it getting better in the White House with all the chaos and particularly the idea that maybe General Flynn will be booted out? Elliot Abrams didn't get the number two job at State Department because Kellyanne Conway showed Trump an article that Abrams had written in the Weekly Standard critical of Trump, and that was enough, even though Kushner and Netanyahu and everybody had weighed in and recommended Elliot Abrams. So,
well, you know, there's always the possibility Trump, this, you know, being crazy every day, will just get tired. He'll get tired of it, and simply he'll become a figure. This is the best possible scenario. He'll become some sort of figurehead and take an adult and put him in charge of the foreign policy and the economy. The problem with the economy is, you know what? I mean, he's turned the economy over to Goldman Sachs.
Mm-hmm.
Entirely. But that catastrophe won't happen for years. I think the stock market's going to go up. They're going to pull off all sorts of whatever regulations there are. People are going to make fast money, and we pay the price 5 years from now. You know. But it's foreign policy, because there is no easy solution in the Middle East. The place is too complex, too subtle for Trump to ever understand, and the people around him as well.
Well, Robert Baer, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Robert Baer, one of the most accomplished agents in CIA history and the winner of the Career Intelligence Medal. He's the author of 4 New York Times bestsellers, including See No Evil and Sleeping with the Devil, How Washington Sold Our Soul for Saudi Crude, and is considered one of the world's foremost authorities on the Middle East, and is the current National Security Affairs Analyst for CNN. And his latest book is The Perfect Kill, 21 Laws for Assassinations. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the visit by the Japanese Prime Minister, which was overshadowed by a North Korean missile launch.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Ellis Krauss, who's a professor emeritus of Japanese politics and policymaking at the University of California, San Diego School of Global Policy and Strategy. He's a leading expert on Japanese politics and U.S.-Japan relations and is the author of Beyond Bilateralism, U.S.-Japan Relations in the New Asia-Pacific, and he is the co-author of The Rise and Fall of Japan's LDP. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ellis Krauss.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
And the Japanese Prime Minister has, first of all, he was the first foreign leader to meet with Donald Trump after his elections. And that meeting apparently was also involved some commercial interests on the part of Trump's daughter and son-in-law. But that aside, they seem to have bonded then, and they bonded further with a golf trip down there to Florida at Trump's Mar-a-Lago resort. And they did have a couple of brief truncated press opportunities, very, very brief statements, again, focusing on North Korea launching a medium-range ballistic missile. So let's begin with that. Why does everybody get hysterical about the North Koreans? It is the tyranny of the weak. They're like pathetic, you know, juvenile delinquents creating havoc just to get some attention.
Well, I always compare North Korea, both under the present dear leader's father and now, to a two-year-old in a playpen with all the adults standing around, and the two-year-old comes over and kicks one of the adults through the bars every once in a while and then runs back to the center, and the adults can't do anything. And the major reason is that even though North Korea is violating UN resolutions and developing nuclear weapons, which of course would be a major instability in the Northeast Pacific, in the adults in the room, that is the great powers, can't do very much, because they could, in a case of an attack or a war, North Korea could level Seoul with conventional weapons in about 40 minutes. So they get away with murder, literally, because of not so much their nuclear weapons, which they only have a few of so far, but because of their conventional weapons and the threat to South Korea. Nevertheless, they are trying to develop a missile that could hit the west coast of the United States, which, of course, we cannot allow. So this is why people get in an uproar over North Korea, which is very unpredictable.
And again, I'm speaking with Ellis Krauss, who's a professor emeritus of Japanese politics and policymaking at the University of California, San Diego School of Global Policy and Strategy. He's a leading expert on Japanese politics and U.S.-Japan relations and is the author of Beyond Bilateralism, U.S.-Japan Relations in the New Asia-Pacific, and the co-author of The Rise and Fall of Japan's LDP. So let's turn to the economic situation, because Japan is a country that's been in a slump for decades, in a kind of deflationary slump, and they don't seem to be ever able to get out of it. Their biggest trading partner, I think, is still China, and of course, Abe's signature achievement was to be a part of the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Trade Partnership, which Trump just tore up. So I don't know how they managed to get around that, except to say that Trump believes in bilateral deals, and he'll do the same on Monday, I guess, with the Canadian leader, tear up NAFTA and revive the U.S.-Canada trade deal. So what can the U.S. do to stimulate Japan's economy, and how does Japan navigate between its biggest market in China and its defense arrangements with the United States?
Well, that, of course, is Abe's biggest dilemma. I mean, so far, in the last couple of decades, the Japanese have been playing it both ways, probably the only smart policy for them, which is to continue their very good trade relationship and economic relationship with Asia, and particularly China, as a hedge against becoming too dependent on the U.S. economically, and at the same time, relying more and more and becoming a better alliance partner, despite the provisions of their constitution, which limit what they can do, with the United States as a hedge against a rising China, which they are very afraid of. So that has been the policy. Abe has been moving closer and closer to the U.S., though, militarily, and this, of course, has riled up China. So this Trump's policies are going to make it even more difficult for Abe because he can't ramp up Japanese defense expenditures or contribution to military contribution to the alliance, which they already make a substantial one through providing 3/4 of the funding for U.S. bases in Japan. The Japanese taxpayers are basically paying for the U.S. to defend them and all of our interests in the Pacific. So Abe can't do very much more because the Japanese public is not very happy about his ramping up defense. This is a major issue that has been with us since, frankly, the 1950s. So he's in a hard spot. And Trump actually cut Abe off at the legs with TPP. Japan had actually ratified TPP even after our election and even after Trump's statements on TPP as a signal to the U.S. to please go ahead with it, because the Japanese really like TPP despite the fact that some interest groups don't, because it excluded China and it meant more business with the U.S. and without China in there. And when I asked my students about Trump ending TPP, I said, who was the greatest beneficiary of the ending of TPP? Every student in my master's class said, China. It was quite obvious that Trump was basically giving China a huge gift by ending TPP suddenly like that. The Chinese are delighted because they were excluded from TPP, and this was an opportunity for Japan to increase its economy, stimulate its economy, and increase its influence in the Pacific. So I don't know what is going to happen. Bilateral deals these days, some of them may work out, but on the other hand, this is not the 1970s or 80s, and I think this is what President Trump does not understand, is that there are now multilateral deals all over the Pacific and in Europe, and therefore other countries have options they did not have back in the 70s and 80s when the U.S. was the big bully and could bully them into trade pacts and concessions. They have other options now. And the WTO, the World Trade Organization, makes a huge difference now as well, because they can take us to the WTO and basically send us before an arbitration panel if they don't like our policies and if they violate WTO world trade regulations. So this is a totally different context than the 1970s or 80s, and I think President Trump seems to be operating from a mindset from the 70s and 80s instead of the 2010s.
Well, what is the position now with the Japanese vis-a-vis, you just mentioned how much they subsidize U.S. bases. Trump accused them of not carrying their weight in terms of defense and being freeloaders. He also suggested that maybe they should get their own nuclear weapons. So what's the latest in terms of Japanese public opinion on those rather extraordinary
statements? It's not going to happen. I mean, because, and here again, Prime Minister Abe is under a very difficult situation in between a rock and a hard place, and that is the Japanese public won't accept rapid and major military buildup. They have a constitution that we gave them and created all these problems, actually, that says they're not even supposed to have an Army, Navy, and Air Force, and they can never go to war. Now, that has been gotten around by Supreme Court in Japan and by reinterpreting the Constitution so that it means only defensive war, and that's why their armed forces have been called the self-defense forces. But the Japanese public doesn't really want to get involved with any U.S. shall we say, actions abroad that aren't in their self-interest, as in any country. And they're not going to accept a rapid buildup of military to help the U.S., except in the defense of Japan. They've done a great deal in the last 30 years to build up their military to help the U.S., in addition to giving us the bases. And they have the second most proficient navy and strongest navy in the Pacific now after the U.S., and 250,000 people under arms. So they are contributing, but the problem is they can, no prime minister in Japan can go very quickly to do much more. They also have a huge budget deficit, the largest of the industrialized world, so they can't spend a huge amount more. Their population is declining, and so it's estimated to go down by 20 or 30 million in the next 20 or 30 years. So they're not a rising power, and they rely on the U.S. for a great deal of their defense, much as Germany does. And Germany, too, has a peace constitution. And I think Mr. Trump is going to have a real problem with both Germany and Japan, because their leaders cannot do very much more, even if they wanted to, given the restraints of public opinion when it comes to the military.
But when you say Japan has the self-defense forces and it has this pacifist constitution from World War II...
Okay, can I just interrupt you there, Ian, for a minute? I hate when people call Japan pacifist.
Sure.
Because... it's not true. Japan has never been pacifist. The only thing that was pacifist about Japan is when we gave them Article 9 of their constitution prohibiting the military and war. That was the most pacifist thing about Japan.
Right.
Japanese public has always accepted the necessity of an alliance with the U.S. There is a substantial minority that never has. But it usually has accepted the alliance with the U.S. and using their military for the defense of Japan. They just don't want to send it overseas and use it for the defense of anybody else. So that's not exactly a pacifist attitude, because real pacifists don't let other countries defend them, and real pacifists don't have a 250,000-man army and are willing to defend their own country. So... I just want to make that clear.
Sure.
That Japan is not pacifist. Sure.
No, I'm glad you did. But let's then extend that then to the Senkaku Islands, these pile of rocks that the Japanese and the Chinese both claim. And the Chinese just sent some warships very close to them the other day. Will Japan go to war over this pile of rocks?
They would be willing to, but they don't want to. And the real question is whether the U.S. would go to war over these pile of rocks. And I don't know, if you've seen pictures of them, but they really are nothing but rocks.
Right.
There's nothing there. And this can drag the world into World War III and the United States. And we're in a bind here, because according to the U.S.-Japan Mutual Security Treaty, we're obligated to defend all territories under Japanese administration. Well, for various reasons, historical and otherwise, both countries claim them. The Chinese claim them because some fisherman was said to be on the islands in the 15th century or something, and the Japanese because they took them over in the 19th century. Nobody knows who's correct. None of this is clear according to international law. But the Japanese do administer them. And so, according to our treaty with Japan, and I think Trump referred to this, we are obligated to defend them no matter what if they are attacked, just as we would any other part of Japan. Now, this is a dilemma for the U.S., because this entraps us into a situation we really don't want to be in, where we could go to war over this pile of rocks. The Japanese, however, will defend them. This has become a major issue in domestic politics, and Mr. Abe has been very firm on that score. And they're beefing up their self-defense forces with mobile units to try and defend them. So the Chinese are going to do what they always do, which is put these, they call them onion or cauliflower tactics, as they are called, which is small pressure constantly, little by little enveloping and trying to get the Japanese and the U.S. to back off. And, of course, we're not. So it's a very dangerous situation.
Well, the Chinese, of course, have built up these artificial islands in the South China Sea against the ruling of the World Court, the United Nations, and they've totally ignored the United Nations. So they've indicated a certain amount of aggressiveness, but I don't know that they're really willing to take on the Japanese over this pile of rocks.
I think they're hoping that eventually it'll become so burdensome for the Japanese to defend these islands, and it is very stressful for the Japanese and the Japanese Maritime Self-Defense Forces. They have Coast Guard cutters there, sending off Chinese fishing boats and Chinese Coast Guard cutters and other Chinese vessels that are constantly prodding and probing. They have a destroyer not very far away from the Maritime Self-Defense Forces as a backup there. But, maintenance costs and other things, the Chinese are hoping the Japanese just get tired of it, but I don't think they will. And I don't see a resolution. The Chinese recently have become more than a little aggressive under President Xi. I think everybody hoped that the Chinese would be peacefully, despite their authoritarian regime, would be peacefully integrated into the World Trade Organization, as they have up to a point, and also into the world norms on defense and security. But that's changed since 2010, and the islands are one major manifestation of that, both the disputed islands with Japan and the ones that they're building in the Pacific. And they've gotten into hassles with the Philippines. The World Court has ruled against them, and it's not going to make any difference. The Chinese see the entire Western Pacific as essentially their Caribbean, that they are going to, should be, by history, masters of, whether it accords with international norms and rules or not.
Well, Ellis Krauss, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Ellis Krauss, who's a professor emeritus of Japanese politics and policymaking at the University of California, San Diego School of Global Policy and Strategy. He's a leading expert on Japanese politics and U.S.-Japan relations and is the author of Beyond Bilateralism, U.S.-Japan Relations in the New Asia-Pacific, and he's the co-author of The Rise and Fall of Japan's LDP. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me and scroll down the right-hand side, sign up for iTunes podcasts, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Bye.